Hello, and welcome to Advisory Explained. I'm your host, Kwesi Kretzinger. Join me in this series, this podcast where we discuss the complex world of advisory. We dive deep into very specific topics in the world of mergers and acquisitions, due diligence, tax, fiduciary services, and so much more, where we take complex topics and we break them down into smaller, bite-sized, palatable portions for you to understand and to understand where we can assist you. Welcome back to another episode of Advisory Explained, where we take complex topics in the world of finance, M&A, tax, and law, and we break it down into easy, digestible pieces for everyone to understand and to enjoy the conversation. So today, I have the pleasure to have Lisa Moldenhauer from the Omni Group here with us, and we are going to discuss the importance of human capital in M&A transactions. Lisa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kwesi.
So before we kick off, can you give us a quick background? Who you are, what do? What does the business do, and what is your level of experience and expertise that you guys actually add value with?
So first of all, my experience is financial services. I always say I grew up in financial services, so I'm very blessed to have that background. And then about 17 years ago, I had the bullish decision as to start an entrepreneurial-based business, and Omni was birthed at that stage. Omni as an ecosystem, we focus on business and human capital development. So where we intersect from a deal-making perspective is we deal with the leaders and the unseen parts of effective deals. And we help leaders navigate that change, cultural shifts, and we also specialize in learning and development quite extensively.
Fantastic. And I think just for all our viewers to sort of quickly explain where and why we're sitting here today is from a Bagatelle Greenwood side, especially in the advisory leg, we do a lot of M&A transactions. We do buy side, we do sell side, we do due diligence and all of that. And throughout all of these transactions, most South African transactions in the private world has a thing called an earnout period. Now, to quickly explain what that is if I sell my business for 100 million rand based on the fact that I make 25 million rand profit a year on a multiple of 4, that gets me to 100 million rand. The fact is the business value is linked to profitability. And me as a buyer or whoever buys the business says, okay, listen, I'll pay you, barring you actually meet those targets that you say you are going to achieve. So that creates a period, an earnout period, where we then discuss and actually have to work the business together to make sure that the guy that sells the business gets all the money he wants for the business, and the guy that buys the business is almost guaranteed and insured to say the business that he's buying is the actual business that he is getting. In that process, we have three sets of people. We have the buyers, we have the sellers, and we have the management team. And all three of them have their own lives, their own personalities, and their own effects on sort of what's happening throughout the transaction, from initial introductions to negotiations to signing the contracts, getting into earnout periods, the CPs that need to be achieved. And in all of that, the business carries on, but there's a level of people matching that happens. And that's why we're here today.
Yeah.
So, Lisa, tell me in your experience, so deals never fail in Excel spreadsheets. They fail because people break it at the end of the day. And out of your experience, why does this happen?
So if we've got to focus on specifically around M&A, there's these micro behaviors that we can't see on the spreadsheets, right? It surfaces as we go through the deal. And that happens for a number of reasons. And one of those reasons of, if we just place ourselves in the shoes of a owner that is now selling their business, it is their baby. And there is a loss that is happening in the process. And a lot of time from a leadership point of view, it's a loss of autonomy. It's a loss of decision-making rights. And that manifests itself within the process as it starts unfolding. Another behavior that comes to the forefront is the influences. And one of the key things that while we are busy with a transaction that we need to understand is a transaction can stall when you have silent influences that manifests in the working environments and they are not proactive enough from a leadership point of view to move towards integration. And that really, especially for the management team that needs to navigate this post-deal, becomes problematic. And then lastly, for me, one of the aspects that is actually critical to also understand is, let's be realistic. How much pressure do we think is happening in a deal? So there's something that happens to us as human beings when we are under pressure, we actually behave differently. And it becomes critical for us to understand how does those behaviors show up. Just like one example that I can think of, if we think about a leader that is potentially highly collaborative, once they're under pressure, it can actually manifest in the form that they stall decision-making. So they don't get to making decisive decisions, which is problematic when we are navigating the deal and the M&A.
Absolutely. And I want to touch on one of the key things you just mentioned is the silent influencers. And the reason for that is I was actually last week in, I'm not allowed to call it PE anymore, but I can't pronounce Quebecca. But in any case, so I was there and we had a conversation with an attorney that did a transaction for in between families. And one of the silent influencers was the absolute reason for the transaction and made it very uncomfortable for everyone. And it was the wife behind the CEO that's running the business, etc. She had her own agenda, etc. And I'm not saying that that's always bad. I'm saying you need to understand who is influencing the decision-making, who adds comments, who speaks to the decision-makers, because it's not always just them making the calls. And you need to be able to understand the lay of the land about everyone that is part of that. And that's quite a difficult thing to manage, don't you think?
Very much so. And the influences are subtle. They're not always in your face, and you do not always know about them in pre. So they show their heads, if I can put it that way, while you're busy with a transaction. And then to manage the potential conflict or fallout from there becomes really difficult for the management team because the level of influence is not always understood. And influence can be a good thing, but it can also be an aspect that derails the transaction or derails the intent. That's why when we do the analysis and we actually work with a leadership team in better understanding the behavioral composition of the buyers and the sellers, we are able to formulate what potential stress points actually sit there. Because that is the unseen. It's not on the balance sheet. But it is the thing that can derail the deal. And understanding those influences becomes critical because you want to draw them in. And if you are able to draw them in, they become champions of the deal and not disruptors of the deal.
Absolutely. And it is so crucial to find out where all of this sits and to be able to understand the behavioral patterns of individuals. I want to touch on another point you made is we all have our sort of rules of engagement as a person. my basic ethos on how I work, my mandate on how I operate works as X, Y, and Z. However, when I'm under pressure, it's like a ball you squeeze. Things go to the side, etc. You guys have a tool that you utilize to determine how I work in my normal capacity, how I work in my home capacity or work capacity, and then in my overly stretched capacity. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit in terms of how, if we have that in place prior to a transaction actually happening in the due diligence process for the buyers, the sellers, and the management team, how we can utilize it? Firstly, how does it work? And then how can we utilize that to manage the transaction as effectively as possible on a people level, not on a deal level, to get to a successful transaction?
So first of all, I want to say that the tool we use, this is not about personality compatibility. I think what we are busy shaping is a leadership operating model. So we've got to take a step back and strategically look at what is the best leadership operating model for pre, during, and post. And part of that evaluation is working with Lumina Spark, which is a behavioral profiling tool. Yes, it gives you insight into how an individual's preference is from an everyday, how they show up every day, but then also when they are underlining as well as overextended. And overextended specifically becomes important within an M&A framework because it is a pressure framework. This is not normal business, right? There's some real targets, real things that need to be achieved. And part of us utilizing the tool is not only helping individuals for them to better understand themselves. So the key benefit is that personal growth. But it also allows individuals to understand, how do I lead? How do I manage under that pressure? And how does my behavior manifest under those pressure points? Because if we take somebody that is highly driven, task orientated, under pressure, they can become conflict seeking. And that can actually, in the deal, derail conversations or cause conflict to happen on the more regular, which then means leaders have to deal with the amount of conflict layers first before they just get to let's talk business and how this is going to work and what next needs to happen and how's integration going to happen. And the time that takes.
And the risk, because that can very much derail negotiations.
Exactly.
If I'm under pressure and you telling me, listen, you're only going to pay me 10 million and I'm saying, listen, no, I want 15 million. But there's a very easy answer now we can get to, an answer that we both get to, but due to the stress, due to the pressure, remember, transactions are a pressure on the one side, but business still needs to go on. This machine still needs to keep on going. And then there is also the big risk of, listen, if this is done, it's done. So I need to do it right. So all of a sudden, there's a lot of pressure on management team, on the negotiation side to perform.
Yep.
Which means they very much quickly get into that overextended mindset or personality side of them, which isn't a bad side, it's just a reality. You need to understand it. And then people become possibly conflict-seeking, possibly overbearing, possibly just accepting, which is a risk in a negotiation point where you don't want to get to conflict, so you just accept and you say, what did I accept? I took a deal that I shouldn't have.
Buyer's remorse then, right?
Buyer's remorse.
And that's why behavior becomes such a critical component. And that is also why we frame it as a leadership operating model, because it's not just about the behavioral profiling. It's also understanding, how do leaders make decisions under this type of transaction? And it's asking the tough questions of, what is the decision tree? What does it look like? And linked to something that you mentioned a little bit earlier was how communication actually takes place, because that's really critical. Because we have communication breakdowns and people read into conversations, but they don't necessarily ask the hard questions while we're in the meeting, while we're having the discussion, while the deal is being formulated. And those are the things that we need to try and uncover so that there's a smoother transition. And one other aspect that also rears its head sometimes is we go and, especially in the earn-out period, when leadership has not been aligned and when behavior and culture specifically has not been spoken about, there's not the rules or guardrails being set up, we very quickly in the earn-out period have excuses for why targets aren't being met, and it becomes external and it's never internalized. And what we should be doing is we should be internalizing, if a target is not met, why is it happening? What is the reason? Is there things that we can do differently to make sure, but we don't have those conversations because it's off the back of things that we have not actually sorted out in pre and during.
Absolutely.
And then it starts unraveling, right?
Absolutely. And that's such a crucial aspect, because I think when we start thinking about the point of communication, I think communication is very much similar to personalities. It changes based on the level of stress you are under. I personally, my way of communication differs. If I'm very relaxed, I'm open, I chat easy, communication happens very, very easy. I overshare certain things. However, the more stress I'm under, I keep quiet. And it's not about I don't want to share. It's about I'm internalizing and I don't want to overly burden everyone else with what's going on in my mind and all of that. But that's a fact that we have to understand and manage in transactions. As a buyer, as a seller, as management team, you need to be able to understand, where am I currently? On my rev meter, am I running at 6,000 revs at the moment instead of 2,000? And what's the effect of it? I'm currently busy with a new book and a principle sort of called Mental Models from Shane Parrish. Incredible literature. And one of the things that they specifically speak about there is two key things that I want to touch on. Is the first one is understanding that the map is not the territory. The map is not the territory. It's only an expression, which means even our estimates and all of the tests that we do on personalities, it's a map of the personality. It's still not the personality. The financial models we build for the transaction and the synergies, it's a map of the possibilities. It's not the same. And the way to explain it, and it's a fantastic explanation that they always give, is if you think about a map, if you look at it holistically, you see the roads, possibly buildings if it's a Google Maps, but other than that, you can only see the roads, but you can put a pin down. You can't see the colors of the building. You can't see what's there at the moment. You can't see if there's been an accident. You can't smell. You can't hear, etc. So there's a lot of assumptions that we miss in it, and we need to understand that in transactions specifically, because we build a model for a deal to work, but what is the human side of it? And the human side of it never comes into the Excel model at the end of the day. And that's such an important thing to do. So before I carry on, Lisa, in your opinion and in your experience, how can we better that principle? How can we better adjust and incorporate the people, the human capital side of it, in specifically starting at the pre-transaction period, getting into the deal-making sort of rhythm more efficiently by taking the people capital side of it into play?
So first of all, I love the analogy with regard to the blueprint. I think that is so important. And I'm a visual thinker, right? So if I can imagine the blueprint, the people for me start bringing the color. they are the people that add to the map that gives the colors of the trees, the buildings, they add to that. And that's linked to people capability. Now, a lot of times what we do in the deal side is we build the deal. We decide what the workflow looks like, right? And then we want to push the people into that workflow. And that's where it unravels. We've got to find a way to match the people integration with while the deal workflow is taking place. Because the people bring capability matrices to the organization. They are either going to contribute to the success or take away. And if you think about it, it's a high change flux, right? So lots of change taking place. And I mean, if we now really want to take it even further back, right now in the world of work, change is a constant. It's not a thing that happens through a change management process and a once-off. I actually personally believe our change management models are old. We actually have to give businesses continuous change cycles. We need to give them access to that, and leaders need to understand that change is continuous. So how do I stay on a treadmill, but getting off of the treadmill so that I can build? In other words, not work with the stress, because that's where the treadmill for me is, it's you in a stress cycle, but rather get to the open road. And that integration between the behavior and the deal becomes really important. That is where executive coaching is critical. You need to help people through their acclimatization of the change, of the transaction, of decisions, rights changing, governance changing. If you just think about a founder entrepreneur that's handing over their business, what do you think is happening to them in earn-out periods? They have governance structures over them. These people worked autonomously. They'd made decisions on the fly. You are now putting a boss over them.
Especially for people that ran their own business for the last 40 years.
Exactly. So how do we think that's going to manifest? It is, and they have the charisma, right? They've still got the capability. Otherwise, in the earnout period, we wouldn't have created structure to say they must be there at least for the next 2 to 5 years. Because we understand that there's certain commercial value tied to a founder. We get that. But what does decision-making look like? What does governance structures look like? What does leadership influence look like? Because leadership influence is more than the task. It's the ability to influence others to get to the goals. So how do we do that? And the only way we can do that is if we actually look at it at a diagnostic level, and that we can actually look at the data from a leadership and capability point of view around the human behavior, and not just the deal value, but what value is sitting within the capabilities of the individuals within the ecosystem.
Absolutely. And I want to specifically speak to one of the points that you just raised is executive coaching. If you think about most business owners and people that we work with that sell their businesses or want to buy a business, most of them are a little bit on the older side. They've got some experience. They probably married. They probably have kids. The fact is, if you have a kid and your kid wants to learn something new, you take them to someone to teach them how to learn something new. If you want to start playing golf, you've never played golf, if you have the financial means, you go buy a golf bag and then you go get golf coaching. If you want to go do a triathlon, you've never ran, swum, or cycled. Now, all of a sudden, you want to go do an Ironman, you're going to go get a coach. So why not get a coach for your business? Why not get a coach for being able to lead the thing that is operating and sustaining you? Why not get a coach for M&A transactions, being able to how to manage the stress, how to manage the communication, how to manage the conflict, how to manage the staff in this process. So, Lisa, on that point, how does this coaching system work And because I know a lot of business leaders say, listen, I don't need a coach. Look what I've built. Why do I need to speak to someone? I've built a successful business. So practically, how do you think we can get people to realize and say, listen, there's a lot that I know, but there's a lot that I don't know?
So I think first for me, when you're dealing with the existing leadership, the founder, the board, right, they will have very much a viewpoint that this is what we've built, this is what we've done, what are you going to coach me on? Which is slightly different. So for us as a business, when we go into a corporate and we have a conversation with them or organization and have a conversation around executive coaching, that is very much tied to increasing performance based on the current lay of the land. Within an M&A, you are going into high flux. But my personal feeling is that right now, executive leadership and leadership is in a continuous flux, right? Therefore, if you are not going to have somebody to talk through challenges from an unbiased perspective, also from a guidance perspective, just like you said very nicely, to create excellence, there are certain sacrifices that is required, and a lot of times that is a coach. And a coach is somebody that is going to call you out. They're not going to tell you what you want to hear. They
a
need
good
to,
coach.
Yes.
A good coach is not going to tell you what
exactly.
You want.
Exactly. They are going to challenge you. They're going to challenge your thought processes, and it's uncomfortable. So I think on a personal level, leadership tends to disengage because it's uncomfortable, or might be they perceive it to be uncomfortable. The other side is we just don't manage the metrics as correctly. We see it as a cost, and it's not a cost. It actually is a return accelerator. Because if you have strong leadership, just think about the depth that a leader can carry if they actually have the right capabilities, the right mix of capabilities. When you think about decision making, one of the biggest things that I personally see in business at the moment is the indecisiveness that sits in leaders because of the fact that there's nearly no predictability. So there's certain things that we can see. But remember, balance sheets look back. They're not looking forward. They're not telling you what the next 5 years is going to look like. Therefore, leaders stall indecision. They look at political, geopolitical climates. They go, no economic growth. We've got to make the decision. Must we make a capital investment? Yes, no. And what happens is they tend to make way more cautionary decisions, which is really bad for growth. And therefore, a coach is somebody that comes alongside you and helps you deal with those decision making, creates the banter. But ultimately, you have to walk away and make the decision, right? Because the consequences sits with the business leaders. But the guidance is necessary. So I am a firm believer that, in my opinion, most executives should have some form of business coach. And sometimes I think that maybe we need a few, because I think we need people to speak into our lives, but differently. Because Lisa, as the business leader, needs a certain level of coaching. But Lisa also as a mother, for argument's sake, there's other people that I need in my circle to help me navigate that, right? Because we have got different hats. We fulfill different roles. I mean, lastly, I just want to say, if leaders are not prepared to put themselves in uncomfortable situations, and I'm talking about the senior leaders, the board, right? We don't give permission for the next tier to do the same, which then means succession in organization stall. And that is a major problem at the moment. We are struggling to find good succession at a senior leadership level because we are not intentional about creating depth in people capability. We just promote people. because they're good at the task. The task does not make a good leader.
Your ability to do the task, absolutely. Completely agree with you. When we bring this back into deal making specifically, you guys also assist with HR side and the human side of due diligence. What is one thing that you guys often see that is completely overlooked, specifically in the due diligence backs on transactions?
So first of all, it's looking for that compatibility, right? And it doesn't mean it's personality alignment. It is the leadership capability that needs to be developed. So where's the deficits? Can we see the deficits? And that's nearly where we look at team dynamics, and we look at the new grouping of leadership and management, and what does that look like, and how are we going to deal with this as we move forward? Then secondly, I think it is the communication strategy. Because what we do is we have one communication strategy, right? But the communication strategy for the buyer versus the communication strategy for the seller is two different things.
And the expectation for the communication strategy in the earnout period also differs.
Exactly. And I think we have a more generic approach, and that hurts us later. So we need to understand the behavioral dynamics that comes with the seller grouping. The seller grouping, there's an element of loss. There's an element of fear that what will happen to us, job security. There's a few questions that happen within the broader ecosystem. So how does that get managed? So I believe that the communication strategy has to be stakeholder specific, but it has to tie back into the strategic intent of the M&A and what are we wanting to achieve. And that for me is quite a critical miss that we have. I mean, lastly, I want to say, we bring the human stuff in post-deal. And then we all of a sudden go, now the people must get along, and we must have one organization, one policy framework, and now we want to start something. In fact, we will save a lot of time, a lot of resistance, if we start with the deal-making process on the pre-stage and start incrementally working from senior leadership right into the earn-out period, because then there's a progressive development and it is not this all of a sudden we're now merging. In an M&A that I was involved with a few years ago, that was a particular challenge. And it was a particular challenge by the new CEO that was appointed, because they operated in fear. Because they feared not being respected by the businesses that came together, that merged. And actually it translated in their leadership being totally undermined, and the CEO didn't last post 2 years.
Sure. And we see that so often. I had a conversation yesterday with one of our clients. We assisted in buying a business a few years ago, and they've been in 4 years through seven CEOs because their strategy was incorrect, and hopefully they've fixed that now. But also the way they approached the people side. And that's where the crux of the matter is. Their approach is what led them to seven failures in 4 years. And people miss the importance of people at the end of the day. For the audience also viewing, so on a personal note, so being one of the directors in advisory, I actually work with Lisa as a coach in terms of how to better communicate, how to better handle stress, how to understand perspectives, how to understand my own stress and how I change in stress levels, how to communicate that back to my peers, my team, and also back to home, back to my wife, how to manage all of that. And it's at a place where I say, yes, I'm not old. Yes, I've got a lot of experience still to gain, but I still realize the fact that I need guidance. I need training to be a better leader, to be a better team leader for the organization that we are building. And I would really encourage everyone to sit back and realize, listen, if I played rugby, I would have had a coach. If I played, if I swam, I would have had a coach. If I played golf, I have a coach. Or I at least watch YouTube videos to improve my swing. Make time and make the decision to invest in coaching at the end of the day. Liz, I want to end off with a question to you. If you could leave other deal makers, other people assisting in transactions, just with one mindset shift in M&A transactions, from your perspective, what would it be?
Don't leave people for lost. Incorporate them from the beginning. Culture is not something on the wall. It's not those beautiful posters. It becomes critical to translate that. So translate your leadership operating model into how the culture needs to be and hold people accountable to steward that. Because in that, you will have effective change, which will lead to effective leadership, which will lead to marginal risk in your actual last period of your M&A. We cannot leave that as the last thought.
Absolutely. And just something on that I quickly want to add is someone once made the comment to me that said, show me your culture, don't tell me your culture.
Exactly, because behavior is seen. We show people every day the culture of our organizations. We don't know it, but we do. And that is why we've got to hold each other accountable to the culture. So agree on what that is in your pre and during, because to do it by post and earn up, it's too late. It genuinely is too late.
Absolutely. Liza, thank you so much for your time. Really enjoyed the conversation. And for everyone listening and watching the podcast, if you have questions in terms of people development, human capital, people matching, and how to build that into your transactions, how to mitigate the risk of a mismatch of alignment in communication, in strategies, in just personalities, and how to match that better, how to work through an earnout period, and even in your organization on how to better build your senior leadership to show the example going down, please feel free, reach out to us, reach out to Liza, and we'll be able to assist you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Did you enjoy this episode? Please like, subscribe, and share with your network.